Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome, welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And we are here this beautiful Saturday morning to read and discuss the newest book by Gary Renard, which is The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. And we've been enjoying reading that book for a while.
and
probably continue, yes, till he has a new book out, probably. Well, no, just kidding. But anyway, having a really interesting morning and had, I don't know, a lot of people, woke up early and were, wide awake and, not like normal, which, you know, is sometimes I'm not so wide awake so early. But this morning, for some reason, 4 o'clock in the morning, I was up and ready to go. So, and here I still am, bright and bushy-tail. But my husband, too, he woke up. Well, the local Army post, which you know is Fort Carson, they have been doing blasting, they're doing exercises, and so they've been huge ordnance. I'm thinking probably more than likely 1,000-pound ordnance, which is the hugest ones there is. But and they've been shaking the here in Pueblo, shaking our house, shaking our windows. It's pretty bizarre.
At 4 in the morning?
Well, they were doing it in the middle of the night.
Mm.
And during because they're practicing, you know, they're getting ready to, you know, go out and bomb people. So they have to practice, you know, how they do it. And, you know.
The forgiveness classroom takes so many forms, doesn't it?
It does. It's just hilarious. And what I notice is that, you know, all day yesterday I thought the neighbors were moving, or I thought they were bringing big trash dumpsters up the street. I kept going out and looking out and going, what is that? What is happening here? Are we having earthquakes or what? And then I realized, I mean, we usually get that, but not that same level of loudness. That's why I think they're really blowing up some big loud ones, big ones. Hmm. But anyway, yeah, I used to work over there. I was mentioning this in the room that I used to be the health, safety, quality, and environmental officer for the company that did the maintenance on the Army post. So we were the ones that actually set up those exercises and, you know, went out and set up the field and, you know, put things where they wanted them. And, you know, so, and we kept the roads and we ran the electrical plant and the wastewater and the water treatment and, you know, everything. The Army post is like a little city. So it's like you're running the whole city. And plus we did all the maintenance and repair on the buildings and the barracks. And we were just all doing all kind of stuff. And so it was an interesting job. I ended up getting fired, and then they I called OSHA on them. And they ended up getting hundreds of thousands of dollars of fines. And losing their business. So, but, you know, don't screw with Lynn, I guess. Or.
I guess I better make sure our house is ergonomic before you arrive.
Oh, no, but no, this was terrible. These people were just outrageous. It was outrageous what they were doing. And I'm not going to go into details, but let's just say the person who worked there before I did actually got hired by the Army to help run the base, run the post, because they thought he did such an outstanding job. And I can tell you that nothing that was required was being done. Very little that was required was being done. So it was pretty bizarre, actually. I mean, I don't even know how they operated. But but they were real up on the environmental stuff. So but that was one thing they were concerned about, because they didn't want the EPA to get on them. But they didn't care about OSHA. at that time, they didn't care about it. Later, they did. But
it just seems like another case study in how, you know, our egos, whether individually or collectively, try to, you know, avoid dealing with the real issues, even the ones that relate to what we call real issues in the dream, at the expense of others. You know, it's always a what's in it for me at the expense of everyone else kind of strategy that the ego has, and inevitably it's got to fail because it's all based on the belief in separation.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And then that's it. And it's interesting, today's lesson kind of, it really points to the fact that not one instant does this world exist. And not one instant does this body exist. It's all a story. It's like a book or a movie in the reels. It's there from beginning to middle to end. It's all there. And it never exists in reality. And that's such a beautiful thought, just to know that.
Mm-hmm. I like the phrase in today's lesson that says, you know, it doesn't represent more than a passing cloud upon a sky eternally serene. And that's kind of a good perspective, is when we get, you know, challenged by things that seem to confront us. And, you know, it's not to minimize or dismiss or make light of things that, you know, anyone's going through. But just to remember that in the bigger scheme of things, all the things that are in space or time can't possibly affect our real identity. And that's why when we identify with things that are ephemeral and come and go and change, whether it's bodies that are born or die or circumstances that come and go, you know, and legions in this lifetime, you know, those don't have any impact at all. They don't endure, as the workbook lesson says, in the mind of God, which is our true identity. Our true being is really is part of that perfect oneness that we never left. And it's a challenge to remember that at times, but that's really, you know, I think that's why one of the few places in the conventional, you know, Christian Bible that I think kind of got through relatively unscathed was, you know, passing through the eye of the needle, you know, the metaphor of a camel passing through the eye of the needle is very simple, but it's not easy, because we have to keep focusing on the contents of our mind, and consistently over time, just look at all the things. I mean, I catch myself on a typical day dozens of times, if not hundreds of times, you know, engaging in some sort of self-deprecating thinking, whether it's direct, which is where I'm, you know, belittling myself in some fashion or other, or assessing my identity as being this seeming separate self with its separate issues and wants and imagined wants and needs. Or, you know, projecting that outward to what seemed to be others. And in my fantasy mind, that's all it is, you know, imagining that what others, quote unquote, do or don't do impacts me, the quote unquote me. And, you know, and not to say that we ignore all that or to minimize that, or, you know, stay away from the polls, or, you know, whatever we feel appropriately called to do in the world, you know, we should continue to do, but just not take it quite so seriously, and just recognize that our true identity has never been impacted by anything that's happened in space and time, including the bodies and personas that we think we inhabit and we think that wall us off from other identities. And what a crazy game, huh?
Oh, exactly. And, yeah. and you know, give up the idea that you have a choice. You know, that's the thing that I think is so hard to understand, is that, you know, you talk about, you know, what am I going to do when I go to the poll? You're going to do what you're going to do because that's what you already signed up to do.
Right.
So it's going to be what it's going to be because that's the way it's going to be. If you don't go to the polls, that's the way it is. If you do go to the polls, that's the way it is. You think that you're going to somehow or the other change the outcome of something by your participation or lack of participation? It's not possible. It's not possible.
So vote anyway.
I know, and we will do it anyway. And why do we do it? Because that's the way it is. The problem is in thinking that any part of it makes a difference.
Right. And every part does make a difference, but the difference. The important difference, I think that's why, of course, Miracles is written on two levels, is that the real difference is made on the level of the mind in terms of which of two thought systems we choose. And all of the seeming choices in the world, as you're pointing out eloquently, Lynn, don't really have any true importance, because they're all choices among illusions. But the real choice is that they're all sort of horizontal, using that metaphor, which I find really helpful. But of course, uses a metaphor of verticality, of, you know, the really kind of above the battleground, or like the Cheshire Cat looking down on the maze or the chessboard or whatever, the battleground. You know, there's that little inward smile that says, wait a minute, I could see peace instead of this. I could see peace instead of the countless, pointless, unfulfilling choices in the world that never make me happy. I could see peace as a possible, not only possible, but probable, and in fact, inescapable outcome from choosing the teacher of peace in my mind, which is the vertical choice, which is basically saying, I can choose to not anchor my identity to something in a dream. I could see myself as being all of spirit, and by seeing everyone else as all of spirit, and that's what liberates me and everyone else. And if I can remember to do that consistently, there's that eye of the needle challenge. If I could just do that all the time, eventually there wouldn't be anything left in the world that's drawing me in and kind of, you know, sucking me into this propaganda machine of the ego that makes it the big deal and keeps me enslaved and everyone else enslaved by my perception and my identification and my interpretation of things. So anyway, enough of that.
Exactly. I just posted something. I posted it in the room and I posted it in the chat here. And it's something that Carrie sent me. And I'm guessing this must be from the master teacher. I'm not sure. But it is exactly what you were just saying, I think. And it says, when one admits to continuing foolishness, he is expressing a state of mind in a high reach of clarity.
Mm-hmm.
Truth is an absolute abstraction. A consciousness in a state of advanced maturation loses the necessity and even capacity for sequential thought. You know, the idea that one thing goes and then next to the next thing, sequential thought. It can no longer identify itself in cause and effect relationships. Its actions become genuinely non-motivated. The idea that the past has nothing reasonably to do with the present makes no sense to a linear space-time rationale. Mm-hmm. In fact, a human definition of rank foolishness would be to find itself in a situation where it could not establish correlating antecedents of thought. A natural man, then, eventually and inevitably, will find a spiritual man foolish. And finally, nothing is more foolish to natural man than a complete commitment to absolute truth. And that's what you were saying. It's like I go between this all day long, right? I go between it all day long. You know, I'm either in this place where, you know, I'm seeing, oh, this is all a dream and it's a story and illusion, and what happens now doesn't have anything to do with what's going to happen next, because it's all part of this vast story, this vast illusion. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, if I go in and vote for a certain person and that person doesn't win, then you know, somehow my vote or non-vote has an impact. But in reality, my vote or non-vote has no impact because there is no 1, 2, 3 relationship here. It's no past or present or future. It's only just this very now. And so staying in this very now place, which is what the lesson is telling us, and looking at these things that pass like clouds across the sky, you know, they have no meaning, and they don't change the sky in any way whatsoever. You know, to be able to look at that and realize that that's really the truth. Yeah, even my own mind tells me that's bullshit, but but really, it's not. I mean, really, it is. You know, the truth is that nothing is except this very instant. And there is no past or future. Mm-hmm. And what happens, this is something to practice I've been doing that you might be interested in, is that I practice being in this moment now, which is, you know, what we do, and seeing those thoughts as they come up as being clouds or just batting them away and not listening or looking or thinking and just staying in this now. And in this moment, we become blissfully happy. You become so happy that you just want to be there in that happiness. But the ego keeps telling you, you can't just sit here all day and be happy. You got to get up and do something. You can't just sit here and be happy. You got to make things happen. You know, food is burning in the oven. You better get up and go. You know, because that's the difference between the natural mind and the spiritual mind, our true mind. And so we are into conflict. But in that moment, just the few moments that you can be in that place, practice just feeling all the happiness and looking around you and seeing all the beauty and seeing all the amazing things. Even if it's a spider web in the corner, how beautiful that is. That spider is so amazing. You know, just looking at everything around you and seeing how infinitely beautiful it actually is when you're not attributing a past and a future and you're just being here in this instant. You know, don't think about where you got that thing or what it means to you. Just look at it and see it for the beautiful thing that it is this very instant in this and experience that happiness. And it's practicing happiness. It's just a practice of being happy. Mm-hmm. And when you practice being happy, even if you do it a couple times a day or 2 or 3 times a day, it shifts and changes the way you see things. Because we're so used to practicing unhappiness. I'm so used to practicing every day being as unhappy as I can be that the practice of happiness is like foreign. And yet I see the light in it and I want to keep doing it. So that's what I'm doing. I'm practicing happiness. So if you just see me just sitting and doing nothing and my dishwater is overflowing on the kitchen floor or it needed to be scrubbed anyway, I'm just being happy.
Yeah, and I think to your point, Lynn, it doesn't mean we don't do those things. It just means that we don't care about the outcome in the sense that we don't care. Our identity isn't under any kind of a threat. I think that's why the opening words of A Course in Miracles, you know, keep coming to mind. Nothing real can be threatened, because if we identify with our reality, which is what doesn't change, then that actually empowers us to be more effective in the dream. Because if we're no longer concerned about the outcome, we will consider doing or not doing things that we might not have considered when we are really constrained enormously by attachment to outcomes. So we might do something that seems very, either unexpected or unlikely, or in many cases, probably most cases, we would do the normal thing, but we wouldn't be invested in, our peace of mind wouldn't be invested in whether things, quote, turn out the way we like, unquote, or not. And that's the big difference, isn't it?
Exactly. And I mean, that's the thing, like voting. You know, if you're going to vote, then you have an investment in the outcome. And for the most part, you've already decided what you want that outcome to be. And so, you know, you don't think about other possibilities. It doesn't occur to you that, you know, someone else, you might vote for something or someone else. And I think you really need to take your ego out of the situation when you go to vote.
Yeah, exactly. So last night I was marking up my ballot, which I always vote by mail because why burn the gas and wait in a line? Seems silly to me. And as I was doing it, I was thinking, well, the Bruce character would like these particular candidates and issues to win or not win. But, you know, during that process, there were moments where, you know, and the idea is to increase those moments where the reality of what we all are, you know, expressing as this Bruce character was just kind of watching, you know, calmly while the little bubbles were being filled in with black ink and saying, this is not changing reality. This is not changing the eternal nature of what we all are, including the self that I think I am, as part of that, you know. And I think that's why it's important, particularly in you know, not only just election years, but throughout the year and throughout all our lives, remember, we're voting 24/7, 365 for one of two thought systems, and that's the elephant in the room, big vote that makes the difference, and not the all the little things that we do. And it doesn't mean we don't do the little things. It just means we don't have our peace of mind invested in what happens or doesn't happen.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And look at how much our peace of mind has been upset because of what happened in an election. And you know, daily, you know, I look at my own mind and I see, my gosh, you know, I'm just as opinionated as hell, and I'm really angry and really upset and afraid and, you know, thinking bad things are happening. And, you know, how I really thought I was beyond that kind of thinking, you know, not totally, but, you know, I didn't think I was so radical about it. But I'm actually pretty radical about my idea of, you know, what I think is right and wrong, good and bad. I've surprised myself.
Well, Shakespeare said it pretty well, too. I mean, nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so, which is to say, in this world, there's plenty of things that are good and bad, and our egos love to, you know, go over Nat's eyebrow differences. I'm laughing because I've worked on a particular project for way longer than I imagine I would, and agonizing over lots of little Nat's eyebrow differences, and yet it's something that I'm thrilled that it's you know, anyway, that's on the side, but the idea is that if we can just remember to not take all that so seriously, and recognize that we're always voting 24/7, 360, you know, every moment we're voting for one of two thought systems, and that makes a huge difference. Whereas all the little things we do in the world, ultimately, sure, they may affect a little tiny part of the world, but it's part. And I think that's why the word partisan and party are good reminders that they're all part of the same root of part and partiality and you know, which basically means incomplete. Or if you want to think of it this way, impure. The only thing that's really pure is perfect oneness. And everything less than that is partial, you know, pun intended. It's either is a favoritism toward one part or another, or it's incomplete, meaning it doesn't have the whole picture. And certainly our egos are basically clueless because, you know, a tiny water molecule in the ocean, you know, which is even not a completely adequate metaphor because all of creation is so much vaster than any one ocean on a little planet, and a molecule is huge compared to the littleness of the ego. How's that for
that's a lot of mixed metaphor.
mixed magnitude metaphors. Yeah. Anyway. What do you say we read some of Gary's wonderful books?
Oh, sure.
We've been rambling. As we often do on these Saturday morning conversations, we've rambled a bit. Well, I have anyway.
Well, I enjoy it, and I think that I get, you know, it all comes together.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
the thing. I've never had it not like, oh, well, this doesn't apply to anything we just talked about. No, that doesn't happen. It always is exactly the right thing. So when did you start? I think I haven't marked where we ended up, but we're talking
about it's kind of between 184 and 185, but you have the digital version, right?
Right.
How about if I start at the top of 184?
Okay.
And then we can, you know, go on from there. It probably a little bit of backtracking, but that's probably useful as we often have found. I'm top of 184 in Gary's fourth book, Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other. A History of Mighty Companions, page 184. We're going to start with Artin saying, remember, God created you. You didn't create him. That's why he takes the final step, which, of course, is metaphor. You simply pick up where you left off, not that you ever really left, with him as creator and you with capital C, and you as creator with a lowercase c. Yeah, I just mentioned the upper and lowercase because that's obviously important. And if I just read it aloud, you'd miss the context. As the Course puts it, not one note in heaven's song was missed.
Hey, that's what we were just talking about.
Yeah. We never left. Didn't skip a beat there, right? But God will always be your creator, and then you create the same as him. The infinite extension of perfect love is not something the finite mind can understand, but the time will come when you'll get to actually experience it. Persa then continues, when it comes to the part of the preface you just read, it reminds me of something we want to make sure people are absolutely clear about. From beginning to end, in all 31 chapters of the text, the workbook, the manual for teachers, the clarification of terms, the psychotherapy section, the song of prayer, everything Helen channeled from 1965 through 1977, the Course is totally consistent and uncompromising. There have been some teachers who think they have found the right interpretation of the Course, meaning their interpretation. Oh, the truth is there is only one possible interpretation of A Course in Miracles. We've been giving it to you since we first started appearing to you 25 years ago. You've also heard it from the Wapnick School. We haven't wavered, and we're glad to see that you haven't either. Gary, yeah, but you'll never stop some people from nitpicking the Course to death. I've had people tell me you can't trust the Course because they've edited out the word souls in the first five chapters, and that word implies individuality and God creating it. Artin, it's certainly true that some people can't be stopped, but the word souls was used temporarily early in the Course for Helen's sake when she was getting used to channeling again. As you know, she worked with Jay in other lifetimes. The word was meant to be a metaphor referring to the seemingly split-off minds of the sonship. Those split-off parts or souls are illusory, and that's how the word was used. Soon after, when Helen had cleared out the cobwebs, that word wasn't used anymore, which is why Jay instructed her to take it out. Why confuse people? They're good enough at doing that themselves, as was eventually proven. The word, boy, isn't that the case. Did I mention last week there's a new, in the new, soon-to-be-released ACIM.org website for the Foundation for Inner Peace, there's a wonderful frequently asked questions section, not to be confused with the frequently asked questions of the FACIM.org website, which has now been published in book form and no longer on the website. But anyway, the new FAQ, not nearly as long, but a lot of great stuff and highly recommended on the new website. I encourage people to read when it comes out because there's some really good stuff in there, including topics such as this, what version of the Course should I read, and you know, what's the difference between some of the other variations of A Course in Miracles that have arisen in recent years, and just a lot of interesting stuff there.
Oh, that's great. You know, I've read a couple of Bob Rosenthal, who is probably involved in that. If you look for book reviews on Amazon, he's done book reviews on the newest version that the Circle of Atonement put out. He's done book reviews on A Course of Love, which people compare to A Course of Miracles. And his reviews are so thoughtful and well-reasoned.
I couldn't agree more. And that's part of what is in this new FAQ, and highly encouraged. And again, couldn't agree more. Bob's commentary is just so right on and thoughtful and even-handed, and it's not mean-spirited in any way whatsoever. It's just very factually saying, here's the difference between the two curricula, you know.
Yeah. Exactly. And it is so clear, and he also, you know, he's not putting his own opinion of things into it.
Right.
It's just, this is what this is and this is what that is. You exactly. You choose what you want.
Yep.
Yeah. I love it.
And as that's also pointed out in that same FAQ, is, you know, if anyone truly reads whatever verse they have in front of them and applies it, you know, the content's still there. You know, obviously it's the decision-making mind's choice that makes all the difference, not the form. I mean, you could, like Ken Wapnick said, you could pick up the phone book, and if you studied it with the Holy Spirit, you'd become enlightened. You know, I'm paraphrasing that greatly, but that was the general idea. Is, you know, it's not the form that makes the difference; it's the choice of which teacher in the mind that makes all the difference. And so that's, and we can always tell that by, am I being kind? Am I? You know, another sort of somewhat objective analysis of, you know, do people enjoy being around me, or do they, you know, cringe? and that's you know, a pretty good, not always, because sometimes people are terrified of anything that confronts their ego. But I think if in general, if you look at, am I peaceful around someone? You know, that's probably a good way to think about it, right?
Anyway. Right. Well, yeah, and you know, Jesus says that, you know, that at that certain place or point where you have accepted this truth, and that you are no longer standing in judgment of the world, that people will love to be around you. That you will have a presence that is benevolent and kind, and you know, people will smile when they think about you. Mm-hmm. You know, this is for reals. You know, Jesus says it. It's not like something, you know, Ken made up or something. You know, Jesus, and I find that it's true. And I also find that whenever there's any person that disapproves of me, or any person of whom I disapprove, that is just an indication to me that I'm not practicing the forgiveness that Jesus is teaching me. I'm still looking at things through a very cloudy ego. So yeah, but people do love you when all you are is love. That's all you project, and that's all people want.
Yeah, and maybe more precisely, the reality of what we all are loves that reality. Because obviously if we're all, you know, kind of a three-part system, as Ken Wapnick pointed out so beautifully in all so many of his lectures and so forth, is that, you know, we have a decision-making faculty, and we have two thought systems that we're constantly choosing between, and the real part of what we are, the same thought system, is forever aligned with that of everyone else, and that's where we feel at peace. But you know, if we're aligned with ego in any given moment, we're going to be threatened by someone expressing their real self, you know, choosing the same teacher in their mind. And this, in the same way that if we're in our, if I'm in my ego mind, I'm not going to hear any right-minded ideas from someone else. They'll still be there for me to draw upon when I let go of my choice for the ego, and that's why I think one of the more inspiring phrases in chapter 5 in the text is, you know, I've saved every loving thought and kindness and purified them of their errors, and you know, essentially, basically, our innocence is intact. You know, we don't have to worry about the crazy stuff that we believe we've done or other people have done. But in order to get past all that, we have to remember the only way out of it is to consistently choose the right teacher in our mind. You know, symbolically, metaphorically, the choice for the same thought system that sees everyone's interest as the same. And that interest being going home from illusion, you know, away from ego's craziness.
And you wouldn't think, you know, if you looked at some people would, but a reasonable person, if you saw a person who was, who had a organic illness of the brain, say, for instance, like Alzheimer's disease or something, in which they were no longer able to recognize people or think the normal way or whatever they're used to, and they have different behaviors, and you wouldn't look at them and blame them for their disease. You wouldn't look at them and say, oh, why are you letting yourself go into this? What is wrong with you? Why are you allowing yourself to forget everybody you know? You know, you don't blame them. Maybe the ego does, but the reasonable person would look and say, you are an unfortunate person whose you know, brain has gone wrong, and it's not your fault. You didn't do it. And yet we look at all our brothers around us and think it is their fault, and we think they're doing it on purpose. But people are not doing this shit on purpose. They're doing this because they are terrified, and they don't understand their own thinking. They don't know why they're terrified. They don't know why it's so scary to have a black person as president of the United States. People were terrified of that. And people in my family were terrified of. They thought terrible things were happening and terrible things, you know, and you would look and say that there's no evidence of this. Why do you think this? And it's because they have a thought in their mind. It's a disease. And all ego thoughts are diseased. Mm-hmm. So
that's why A Course in Miracles refers to, you know, uses the word sickness, but it's always talking about the mind. So it's really, you know, a mental illness is, as the Course would say, and the only mental illness is the belief in separation. That's the only thing that needs to be healed, and that's what the atonement or salvation in the Course, you know, using those redefined religious terms, is all about. It's basically saying in order to be free, in order to be happy and consistently at peace, we need to, and as Tim Wise points out, we must. He did a class the other day showing, you know, over 1,000 times, I think, that the word must appears in the Course. You know, we must discipline our minds by not any kind of mean or, you know, authoritarian kind of way, but just gently just say, hey, this isn't working for me. But just look at the contents of our minds, and when it's not working, say, I must have chosen wrongly because I'm not at peace. I think I can go back to Holy Spirit's counsel and be peaceful again. Why not? Let's do that. How about if I finish reading that paragraph?
Yeah, go ahead. Continue reading.
Okay, so I'll start that paragraph over. Soon after, when Helen had cleared out the cobwebs, that word wasn't used anymore, which is why Jay instructed her to take it out. I was referring to the word souls. Why confuse people? They're good enough at doing that themselves, as was eventually proven. The word sonship and the description of sons of God were soon used instead. But whenever the Course refers to sons of God or anything plural, like those who have yet to change their minds, that's metaphor. It's clear the Course is saying that in reality, there's only God's one Son, which is Christ, perfect oneness and the same as God. And tag, we're all it, just in case there's any doubt there. But the ego will do anything to cling to the idea of individuality and separation. There we have the big challenge, isn't it? Because we all think we're individuals and separate from each other by ego default, but certainly not in truth. Should you want to go on where Persa picks up?
Sure. So Persa says, I want to put together a couple of things with an idea you talked about earlier. You said that you were at the airport and you were really tired. Then you started to realize that you weren't tired, but you were having a dream of being tired. In truth, since you're not a body, you can't be tired. Only the mind can think it is. Try applying this to sickness and pain. As you know from the Course and from our discussions, all sickness and pain are of the mind. It's the mind of the patient that is really the physician. I want you to put that together with a few of the other ideas from the Course we've already used. 1. The body is outside of you and not your concern. This removes you from the idea you're in a body. And two, you would not react at all to figures in a dream you knew that if you knew that you were dreaming. I want to make that idea, take that idea and apply. I am not reading good today. Okay, I want you to take that idea and apply it to your own body. So the two things are, the body is outside of you and not your concern. And the other thing is, you would not react at all to figures in a dream you knew that you were dreaming. So I want you to take that idea and apply it to your own body. Once you get used to the idea that the bodies you're seeing are nothing but dream figures that you don't even have to let affect you, you then want to start getting used to the idea that your own body is nothing but a figure in the dream, and that you don't have to let it affect you either. You don't have to react to your own body any more than any other dream figures. Three, what you really are is totally innocent, at home in God, taken care of by Him forever. So the next time you feel tired, sick, or have any pain, remember these three ideas and put them together. All right, I'm not a body. My body's outside of me. I wouldn't react to the figures in a dream that I knew I was dreaming, and that I am totally innocent at home in God.
Sounds like a good collection of three maxims to put on a little magnet for the inside of your medicine cabinet, huh?
Uh-huh. Or your eyelids. Or your
there you go.
On the inside of your eyelid. So Gary says, got it. Well, I'll paraphrase. One, the body is outside of me and not my concern. It has nothing to do with me. Two, I would not react at all to a figure in the dream I knew I was dreaming. So why react to my own body? It's not what I am. I'm not in it. It's just a figure in a dream. And now that I know I'm dreaming, I don't have to let it affect me. If I'm not in a body, I'm not really feeling pain. I'm just dreaming that I'm feeling pain. I don't have to make it real. And three, what I really am is completely innocent. God loves me and will take care of me forever. It's three really great thoughts that
and put forever together. Has no expiration date.
Yeah.
Fortunately for us.
Okay. So do you want to read?
Sure. Persis says, yes, and try to visualize yourself as being outside of your body as mind. When you do that, your awareness is potentially unlimited. The mind can go anywhere and be anywhere. A body cannot. Actually, in my second book, I had a little exercise of, basically imagining yourself in, you know, different parts of the planet, different parts, different galaxies, you know, and recognizing, wow, you can travel instantaneously, just like, you know, quantum bits or qubits can share data from anywhere in the cosmos instantaneously. And transcend the supposed laws of space and time. We can, that's because it's a mental thing. And that's why, you know, mind can no longer be removed from physics because of the quantum experiment of, you know, the dual slit experiment, basically. Yeah.
Well, and it wouldn't exist if it wasn't in your mind.
Yeah, that's, exactly.
You would not know it if it wasn't in your mind. It would not exist for me if it wasn't in my mind.
Exactly.
And how I look at this is from a distance. You know, that Jesus talks about above the battleground. And when you're above the battleground or from a distance, like that beautiful Bette Midler song, mm-hmm. Everything looks harmonious. You see the whole and not the many broken parts. It's like looking at a mosaic. You know, from a distance, you see the picture, the figure, and what it is, but it's all made up of little broken pieces of something or the other. That's really what we're talking about is, you know, I'm not wandering around looking at all the broken parts. I'm up here looking at the wholeness of it and recognizing nothing is broken.
I have a particularly silly example of that. I'm reading from Gary's book, and sitting next to it on my desk is another book that's being used to prop up one of my computer monitors, and it's an art history book that my wife used when she took an art history class many years ago, and it's the Janssen History of Art. Now, if I have my eyeglass case propped up against that book, all I see is the word fart. But if I drop that down to get the bigger picture, I see history of art, and then it means something completely different. So I think that's a good example of how, you know, we take things personally and out of context, and we don't get the big picture because we're partisan. You know, we think we're part of the story instead of recognizing that we're all the whole story. We're all the whole innocence. We're all the whole completion. And the ego's assessment of us is just like a little fart that a little wisp that never happened. How's that for
I love that.
Spontaneous
for something completely
analogy.
Different.
Exactly.
The world becomes a fart. I love it. It's so true. My goodness. And you know, just as you're talking, I'm like, well, you know, I wouldn't even know this. I mean, this wouldn't even exist if I wasn't here hearing about it.
Right.
This would not even be if I wasn't here observing it. It would not even be if I wasn't here knowing, thinking about it, imagining a story about it. It would not even be. And it's just amazing. I love it. Transcendent Saturdays. Okay. So where are you at?
Let's see. Why don't I start again at the top of page 186 here? So Persis says, yes, and try to visualize yourself as being outside of your body as mind. When you do that, your awareness is potentially unlimited. The mind can go anywhere where a body cannot. Carry. I like it. I'll do it. Say, how did Jay heal the sick? You're saying it's the patient's mind that does it. So what part was his in it? Persa, he answers that for you in the manual for teachers, but most people don't pay attention because they want to be great healers who lay their hands on others and get a lot of credit. Find, quote, the function of the teacher of God, unquote, and read the second and third paragraphs. And then Jay knows that the sick person, thinking he or she is guilty, has chosen to be sick at the level of the unconscious. And what Jay describes in the manual is the same way he approached the sick at the level of the mind 2,000 years ago. Of course, you have to realize his awareness was total. He could join with the sick person on a deep level, and the sick person would get where he was coming from, even though nothing was being said. As you start reading, Jay is talking about the person who has chosen to be sick. Gary, okay. Do you want to read that part?
Okay, I'll read that.
Okay.
Okay, so this is from the Manual for Teachers, and it's a section of the function of the teacher of God, and this is the second paragraph. To them, God's teachers come to represent another choice which they had forgotten. The simple presence of a teacher of God is the reminder. His thoughts ask for the right to question that the patient has what the patient has accepted as true. As God's messengers, his teachers are the symbols of salvation. They ask the patient for forgiveness for God's Son in his own name. They stand for the alternative. With God's word in their minds, they come in benediction, not to heal the sick, but to remind them of the remedy God has already given them. It is not their hands that heal. It is not their voice that speaks the will of God. They merely give what has been given them. Very gently they call to their brothers to turn away from death. Quote, behold, you Son of God, what life can offer you? Would you choose sickness in place of this? Unquote. Not once do the advanced teachers of God consider the forms of sickness in which their brother believes. To do this is to forget that all of them have the same purpose and therefore are not really different. They seek for God's voice in this brother who would so deceive himself as to believe God's Son can suffer. And they remind him that he did not make himself and must remain as God created him. They recognize illusions can have no effect. The truth in their minds reaches out to the truth in the minds of their brothers, so that illusions are not reinforced. They are thus brought to truth. Truth is not brought to them. So they are dispelled not by the will of another, but by the union of the one will with itself. And this is the function of God's teachers. to see no will as separate from their own, nor theirs as separate from God's. Mm-hmm. And is this not, I mean, really honestly, how is healing accomplished? It's by what Jesus called charity, looking at your brother and seeing him as being far beyond where he appears to be, and reaching to that being. It's miracle principles, numbers 7 and number 8.
Yeah. You know, I don't think we need to actually, A Course in Miracles, as Ken Wapnick points out so eloquently over and over, it's not a course in yes, it's a course in not no. So it's essentially denying the denial of truth. Or in everyday terms, if we can recognize when we are projecting guilt onto someone else and see it as our own healing that's needed, that's when, you know, we're on the right track. Because, I think one of the most telling lines in helpful for me is that question, would I accuse myself of this? And if I can ask myself that, if anything that I'm wanting as an ego to condemn or to damn and make wrong, if I can say, wow, instead of seeing this as ego does, if I can see it as a call for love, then I'm healed, because I'm letting nothing obstruct my understanding of the so-called other. And then at that moment, we are the same as, you know, like Arden and Purser saying, you know, Jay just reached into, you know, deeply to the level of the truth of what, you know, each person, seeming individual was, and recognize it's no different than the capital S self. And that's where the real healing happens, isn't it?
It is. And it's like in the psychotherapy pamphlet, and I was looking for it because I don't remember exactly what it says, but I think it says healing occurs when the therapist forgets to judge the patient.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's pretty close to the quote. That's my favorite quote from that pamphlet too. So
yeah.
I mean, it's such a great succinct summary of the whole point of that, you know, curriculum. Yeah.
Exactly, and that's it. You know, when Jesus didn't condemn.
Yeah.
He didn't judge. He didn't look and see, you know, you could be different, or, you know, why did you do that? Or, you know, he looked, you know, the guy who was sitting at the edge of the lake. And the legend was that if you were there when the first breath of air came across the lake in the morning, that you could receive the blessing of an angel and be healed. And this guy had been there like 20 years, sitting there waiting to be healed. And Jesus came up to him and he looked at him and goes, you know, what are you doing here? And the guy goes, well, I'm waiting to be healed. And Jesus said, pick up your bed and walk. And because Jesus didn't see anything that needed to be healed, he saw the wholeness of the person, and the guy stood up, picked up his bed and walked. Or Jesus would be just walking along, and people would reach out to him, and he would say, who touched me? And that person was healed, not because, you know, because Jesus did anything. He just didn't see sickness. He saw them as they truly were, and it caused them to be healed. And that's a no small thing. You know, Joel Goldsmith did that. There's a lot of people who are true healers who have actually done that. But it's not something you aspire to. It's something that occurs because you stop judging. You know,
yeah, and I suspect in that era too that probably wasn't king sized mattresses with pillow top stuff. So when he picked up his bed, it probably wasn't as big a deal that just as when you move into a new place now, you know, you've got these.
No, it was not like that.
Larger box springs and stuff to, you know, it wasn't that much of a big deal.
Yeah. That would have even been more of a miracle. pick up your thermal whatever that mattress is.
It's
all
right.
Thick and,
but,
yeah.
But no matter what. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No matter what the era, it's always easier with another person. working in harmony and alignment, right?
Absolutely. Yep. Okay. Let's see. Well, where are we? I think
you started reading it. The next time you go to see someone in the hospital, is it a friend?
Because I just finished reading that long quote from the book.
Yeah.
Okay, so Persa says, the next time you go to see someone in the hospital or visit a friend who is, turn the page, sick at home, read that first. It will remind you of the attitude of the advanced teacher of God. Gary, I will, and I think I grasp what it's saying. I'm not totally out of it. Persa then says, just as long as you're not totally into it, don't try to be a big shot healer. And if someone gets well in your presence, don't take any credit for it. Just refer them to the section of the manual you just read from. Artin, so you've learned from the Course that in your present state you are a mind and that you have the power to choose. And what you choose to believe in is what will affect you and ultimately determine what you believe you are. Never underestimate the power of the mind. With its choices, you will remain separate from your source in your experience and feel like an ego among egos, or you will return home to your source in the glorious condition of oneness, guided there by the Holy Spirit. You've learned from the Course that the mind is the activating agent of spirit. Use this mind to go in the right direction with every choice you make. In doing so, you can be enlightened in this lifetime. Let's see. You wanna read?
Sure.
We got a few more minutes.
Gary says, that would be fine with me. You know, most of the time I've been getting better and better practicing forgiveness. It's like when I was a guitar player. I keep finding better ways to play just by doing it. It's the same with forgiveness. The more you do it, the better you get at it. But the one thing that bothers me is that even though I've been doing it for a long time, once in a while, forgiveness is still really hard. Some things still push my buttons. And I heard Ken say that he even got annoyed once in a while. Does that ever end? Artin, the time comes when, yes, it does end. It did for Ken. It takes much dedication and practice, and you'll have the frustration you just mentioned. You'll wonder if you'll ever get to the point where nothing bothers you. When that happens, remember, you can't always see the results of your forgiveness and the healing results, and you can't judge what you can't see. The Course says it is not the function of God's teachers to evaluate the outcome of their gifts. It is merely their function to give them. Have faith and the time will come when peace is totally restored to your mind, no matter what appears to happen. In the meantime, you're getting much better. Aren't you at peace most of the time? Gary, that's true. I remember what I was like just before you appeared to me for the first time. I was anything but peaceful. I worried about everything. I mean, I worried so much I didn't even know I was worrying. I just thought it was normal. Except for my brother, Paul, there was hardly anyone I had a nice, peaceful relationship with. I couldn't make anything work. Even though I'd been on a spiritual path for about 15 years at the time, my life still sucked. Yeah, it was a lot better than it was before I got on a spiritual path, which tells you how much my life must have sucked back then. But like I told you before, there was something missing. I got so much into the presidential election of 92, I almost made myself sick. I wasn't happy at all, and I had no idea what to do about it. Then I remember very clearly I made a decision. I said to myself, I want to remove conflict from my life. I had no idea what a tall order that was because I didn't know how much conflict I had in my mind. And I'm not blaming anybody else for the way I felt. It was me. Even then, because of EST, an Earhart Seminars training that he took years ago, I'd already learned I wasn't a victim. I knew there wasn't any power in that, and I made that decision. I think it was that decision that led to you guys showing up to me. I had to be ready to hear what you had to say. Applying what you've taught me, I've changed so much with the Course that I guess I usually forget about the way I used to be. Like most people, I think I was always this way, but I wasn't. When I think about it, I can see that I've changed enormously. I don't worry about things the way I used to. I don't care as much about what people think. I remember it used to be so important how I looked. Now, who cares? We're all going to be dead in a few years anyway. Let's forgive, move on, have a good time. Today, I can't think of anyone I don't have a forgiven relationship with. And speaking on the road is easy. The first time I got up and talked about the Course in front of people, I was terrified. After 5 or 6 times and a lot of forgiveness, it was no big deal. It was fun. Today, it's no more stressful than brushing my teeth. Travel is still a forgiveness opportunity, though. When I started, it was cool. Back then, the airlines treated me like I was a customer. Now they treat me like I'm a suspect. So does the TSA, even though I have a KTN, a, quote, known traveler number, unquote, which gets me on the pre-checklist. That's supposed to get me through security faster, but they still treat me like there's something wrong with me. I wonder if it's because of what I've written. I forgot that.
People in the TSA were reading the disappearance of you.
Yeah, really.
I think that would be some good news.
Well, it's controversial and radical in the best possible of ways, but some people don't get that, right? Anyway, at least now I know what it's all for. So if I take the time to think about it, yes, everything is different than when you first came to me, and I can tell the process is accelerating. I've been hurt in a couple of minor accidents, and it should have made me feel pain, but it didn't. And I thought, that's strange. That should hurt. My body's more elastic, and it feels lighter, even though I weigh more than I used to. It's a figure in a dream. You know what? I'm going to start feeling more grateful. Thank you. You've given me even more to think about and work with.
Very cool. All right. Thank you so much, Bruce Ross.
Yes.
We're a little over our time, but that's our. I'm sure that Carrie and Iris don't mind a bit. But thank you so much, Bruce Ross. And please, everybody, join us next week, and we'll working on finish. This is really interesting and fun.
Yeah,
so
we've got.
I hope y'all are enjoying it as
pages
well.
Left.
All right. Yeah, exactly. Not far. Yeah. All right. Well, I love you, Bruce. I'll talk
Likewise.
To you next Saturday.
Have a great week, all.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.